WPIND.org.
Heading up to noon, let's get the latest on an earlier truck fire in the Caldecott Tunnel eastbound. Here's Julie Tepish.
Hey, Dave, still big problems here. The traffic alert eastbound 24, the Caldecott Tunnel. Now, the left bore is closed, even though you mentioned that truck fire is out. The traffic only getting by the right lane of the right bore. Very slow back to Broadway. Clearing a five-vehicle wreck in Concord. It's Highway 4 westbound at Willow Pass Road. Still some activity here on the right-hand shoulder. And Bart's dealing with police activity. Trains are not stopping at Balboa Park on the San Francisco line. Julie Depish for KQED.
Support for KQED's current donation program comes from local Kia dealers, introducing the EV6, available with AR windshield head-up display, providing turn-by-turn directions, hazard warnings, and more. More info at kia.com. More here and now at noon on KQED San Francisco and KQEI North Highlands, Sacramento.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Vipa Fernandez.
And I'm Asma Khalid. It's Here and Now.
Coming up, President Biden is announcing a new plan today that gives him the power to cap the number of people crossing the southern border. We'll have the latest.
Also, after 6 weeks of voting in India, Prime Minister Narendra Modi is expected to win an historic third term in office, but not with the huge landslide he expected. His party will have fewer seats than the supermajority he wanted.
And what happened when a museum in tiny Brownsburg, Virginia, worked with the descendants of slavery to uncover the history in the town's past?
It's his handwriting.
Yes.
It just smacks you in the face. I have three sons. I want them to know this is who they are.
Coming up on Here and Now. First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Asylum seekers who cross the southern U.S. border illegally may now be turned away under President Biden's latest executive order. The restrictions kick in when the seven-day average of daily border crossings surpasses 2,500.
Frankly, I would have preferred to address this issue through bipartisan legislation because that's the only way to actually get the kind of system we have now that's broken, fixed, to hire more Border Patrol agents, more asylum officers, more judges. But Republicans have left me no choice.
Many Republicans walked away from a bipartisan comprehensive immigration bill in the U.S. Senate after former President Donald Trump raised objections. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi has claimed victory after he appeared to win a historic third term in office. It came after a six-week-long election where nearly a billion people were eligible to vote. NPR's Dia Hadid has the latest from New Delhi.
Supporters greeted the Prime Minister as he prepared to speak at his party's headquarters in the Indian capital. He tells them, on this auspicious day, the NDA will form government for the third time. The NDA refers to the National Democratic Alliance, a political alliance led by Modi's party, the BJP. Modi's victory was far from the sweep he had promised his supporters, or what exit polls suggested. According to the Election Commission of India, Modi's BJP party is likely to win less than a simple majority. Modi is expected to now lead a coalition government in his third term. Dia Hadid, NPR News, New Delhi.
The chief judge of a federal appeals court in Atlanta says the court will not accept any new complaints about the judge overseeing former President Donald Trump's trial on charges of mishandling classified documents. The court says the complaints appear to be part of an orchestrated campaign. NPR's Greg Allen reports Judge Eileen Cannon, who is a Trump appointee, has been criticized for rulings that have favored the former president and delay the start of the trial.
11th Circuit Court of Appeals Chief Judge William Pryor Jr. says before May 16th, the court had received multiple complaints accusing Judge Cannon of judicial misconduct. Judge Pryor says since then, it's received more than 1,000 additional complaints raising similar allegations. Many of the complaints question her rulings and delays in issuing decisions and ask that she be removed from the case. Judge Pryor says under federal judicial guidelines, questions about the correctness of a judge's ruling or her failure to recuse do not constitute misconduct unless there's an improper motive. And he says the allegations about Judge Cannon's motives are, quote, speculative and unsupported by any evidence. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 84 points at 38,655. It's NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Paul Lancour. The first heat wave of the year is baking Northern California starting today. The National Weather Service has issued a heat advisory through Thursday for interior parts of Napa, Sonoma, Contra Costa, and Alameda counties. Santa Clara County joins the advisory tomorrow. Forecasters say that it will be the hottest day of the week. Meteorologist Dial Hong said temperatures could soar to 100 degrees in the North and South Bays, reach 80 degrees in San Francisco, and the upper 90s in San Jose.
So we're advising people to take frequent breaks in the shade, drink lots of water, and never leave children or pets in unattended vehicles.
Temperatures should drop a few degrees Thursday, and a slight warm-up will remain throughout the weekend. CAL FIRE is investigating the cause of a major wildfire this past weekend that started at a site maintained by Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. KQED's Dan Brecke reports.
The Alameda County Fire Department was the first to respond to the Corral Fire Saturday afternoon. A fire dispatcher advised arriving crews that active power lines were down in the area. CAL FIRE Battalion Chief Josh Silvera says that's one of many possible causes that investigators will look at.
We're going to rule out power lines down. We're going to rule out wind causing power lines to slap, vehicle exhaust, trailer chains dragging and creating a spark. The investigation team is going to do everything in their power to figure out what truly caused this.
The 14,000-acre fire burned one home and closed a 15-mile stretch of Interstate 580 for a full day. I'm Dan Brecke, KQED News.
And I'm Paul Lancour.
Afternoon support comes from European Sleepworks in Berkeley, where research-driven design helps yield sustainable mattress comfort. Learn more at sleepworks.com. Support for NPR comes from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And the listeners and members of KQED. For the afternoon, some of the high temperatures predicted for San Francisco, 78 today, maybe 86 in Oakland, 90 San Rafael, 96 in Napa, 97 in Concord and Livermore, 101 in Sacramento today, up to 104 tomorrow.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Vipa Fernandez in Alameda, California. And I'm Asma Khalid in Boston. It's Here and Now. Today, President Biden is announcing new executive action to dramatically limit the number of migrants crossing into the United States from the southern border.
Doing nothing is not an option. We have to act. We must act consistent with both our law and our values. Our values, Americans.
If more than 2,500 people a day try to cross into the U.S. illegally, that is, between ports of entry and without an appointment to see a border agent, migrants would not be allowed in until the levels dropped to 1,500. Those numbers are daily averages over a week. The move has sparked a lot of legal and political questions, and to help us make sense of the news, we're joined now by Camilo Montoya Galvez, who covers immigration and politics for CBS News. He joins us from El Paso, Texas. Hey there, Camilo.
Hello. Thank you for the invitation.
Thanks. So to put this in perspective, this appears to be the strictest border policy change that we've seen from this White House and this president to date. And it's noteworthy, I think, because President Biden is someone who campaigned during the 2020 election as a politician who would overturn his predecessor's tough immigration restrictions.
Yes, that's right. Soon after taking office, President Biden actually said that he would restore the U.S. asylum system, Asma, and he strongly denounced Trump administration border policies that he believed were draconian and inhumane. But 3 years later, his administration is finding itself embracing very drastic limits on asylum. As he just laid out, this executive action will essentially shut down asylum processing between ports of entry along the U.S.-Mexico border, and it will be in place effectively indefinitely, because the only way that the shutdown of asylum claims between ports of entry will be lifted is once the weekly average of daily illegal crossings falls below 1,500. That is a very low number that we have not seen in years, and the administration is planning to use this executive action, OSMA, to more rapidly reject and deport migrants to Mexico or their home countries. Importantly, asylum processing will continue at official border crossings, right, and there are some exceptions, including for unaccompanied children.
Okay. So, Camilo, I've got a couple of follow-ups there. The number that would target this cap, it sounds like, the cap is 2,500 people. According to my information, we are already at a point where more than 2,500 people are attempting to cross per day into the United States. So does that mean that the border, that this asylum processing would essentially shut down immediately today, tonight?
Yes, the regulation is actually set to take effect on paper at midnight tonight, and so it will take effect soon after President Biden is set to sign it into an executive action. And again, it will remain in place until a weekly average of daily illegal crossings dips below 1,500. And even if that happens, Asma, it could be restored once the weekly average surpasses that 2,500 threshold that you outlined. So this order, again, will likely be in place for weeks, if not months, unless the administration is sued over this policy, which is very likely, and it gets held up in court.
So let me ask you about this, because when I saw the news, it seemed to echo an initiative that the former president, Donald Trump, tried to do. That initiative got tied up in the courts. How is this different than what the Trump administration did?
That is an excellent question, Asma, because this executive order relies on the same legal authority that the Trump administration invoked to enact several immigration restrictions, including that infamous travel ban targeting Muslim-majority countries. Mm-hmm. But the Trump administration also issued a similar asylum restriction using the same law, and that was held up in court. But the Biden administration is saying that this time they will be able to prevail legally in federal court because this regulation has broader exemptions for migrants, including unaccompanied children and those who are fleeing imminent harm or have medical conditions, but because they're also processing 1,500 people per day at the ports of entry.
What are you hearing? I mean, do you get the sense that it has more legal ground to stand up on?
Well, I actually just reached out to Lee Gallant, the top ACLU immigration attorney, and he said that the organization is preparing to sue over this policy. So we could see a lower court at least enjoin and block this policy, but I think ultimately this will be decided by the Supreme Court. And again, the Biden administration is confident that at least when it gets to that higher court level, they will prevail in court.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's hard for me to ignore the fact that this White House is announcing these rules just months away from a presidential election. And we are in a climate in which poll after poll has shown one of Biden's biggest political vulnerabilities appears to be immigration and border policy. I'm curious why you see him making this move now, just briefly.
Well, this is happening, Asma, right after the presidential elections in Mexico on Sunday and before the first presidential debate between former President Donald Trump and his likely rival in November, President Biden. So this is very much political in nature, and some administration officials will concede that privately. Mm-hmm. Immigration, as you know, has become one of the top concerns among American voters heading into President Biden's reelection. They know it is a tricky political issue for them, and they are trying to convey that the president is taking a tougher, stronger stance at the border, but only time will tell whether this will have the intended political impact.
All right. Thanks so much, Camilo.
Thanks, Asma.
Camilo Montoya-Galvez covers immigration and politics for CBS News.
Now to India, where Prime Minister Narendra Modi is claiming victory as he is on track to win a third term in office. In a post on X, Modi wrote, quote, "We will continue the good work done in the last decade to keep fulfilling the aspirations of people," end quote. But in a surprising turn, the outcome likely won't be a runaway victory for his Bharatiya Janata Party, or the BJP. Modi will likely have to rule via a coalition government for his third term. All this follows a six-week-long election in which close to a billion people were eligible to vote. Ballots are still being counted. Jawaharlal Nehru is the only other prime minister to serve three terms. Akash Hassan has been covering the elections for The Guardian and elsewhere. He's based in Delhi, and I spoke with him earlier today. I started by asking him what he was hearing from voters.
There is excitement, of course, on the both sides. That's from the BJP voters, their supporters. But there is a lot of excitement in the opposition camp. Perhaps they were not expecting such an performance. The India Alliance, which is in the opposition, has certainly outperformed the expectations.
So was that a surprise? I mean, Modi was expected to have yet another landslide like he did in the last election to possibly get like a supermajority. Now they're going to, in the parliamentary model, have to work with other parties. Who is the opposition here? Is it the Congress Party that has for so long ruled India before the BJP?
Yes, it's the Congress Party, which is basically winning, but with the other parties which are with it in the alliance. These are around 20 parties and are winning on around 230 seats. But on the ground, the mood has started to shift from the Modi. Though he got he is very close to simple majority, he has not got a landslide victory. And that is a surprise in this.
Okay. So I think one of the places where some of this opposition, maybe surprisingly, maybe not, has come from is rural India. You were out reporting in the Melghat region of Maharashtra. In the villages you visited, what did people tell you about what they wanted out of this election?
Yes, rural areas have certainly surprised in this election, and they have voted for the opposition. The reason is Modi's policies do not seem to have reached to these far remote places, and they do not seem very happy with Mr. Modi. For example, in this Melghat region, we witnessed that there is still huge malnutrition among the children. Every alternate day, one children is, you know, dies because of malnutrition. So while there have been these big policies by Mr. Modi, where he has been talking about taking India to becoming third largest economy, he certainly has not been able to, you know, reach to the ground, to the poorest. And a big thing in India has been the widening wealth gap.
And your reporting really points that out well. We'll link to your article in The Guardian on our site. I found it fascinating that you found in the villages things like toilets and water faucets that Modi promised for every home. Maybe they're there, but there's no water coming into the homes. You know, I'm wondering, we've also heard that under Modi, Muslims and other minorities have been targeted as the BJP pushes a very strident version of Hindu nationalism. Is it too early to say what these results might mean for marginalized groups?
It certainly is not too early to say, because Mr. Modi's party and then his government has been, you know, it stands accused of authoritarianism and pursuing the Hindu first policies. And if we look in the in these polls, the promises Mr. Modi and his party made were similar to, you know, to the policies which are anti-Muslim, which are anti-minorities. So Modi basically wins elections on the promises, on the policies which are anti-Muslim.
Will the opposition parties maybe be a check on some of the anti-Muslim policies or programs that are going on?
I think while Modi's predominantly policies have been anti-Muslim, the bigger number opposition has got this time will certainly be a check on Mr. Modi's anti-Muslim and anti-minority policies.
And finally, Akash, there's also a very big worry about the authoritarian creep of Modi's government. What will happen next, in your view? Do you think that not having a supermajority will reel that in somewhat?
I think it definitely pushes Modi to a position where he will not be able to take as bold decisions as he was able to take previously, or ones he had promised. So it certainly, in my opinion, means that Mr. Modi will be on the back foot, and there will be more checks on his authoritarian policies from the stronger opposition now.
Akash Hassan is a journalist covering the elections. His work has been published in The Guardian and elsewhere. Akash, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
It's Here and Now.
It might be easy to forget about COVID this summer, but new waves have emerged each year among all those vacation plans and air-conditioned gatherings.
The virus continues to evolve to try to escape the wall of immunity we have built up through vaccines and infections.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. What to expect from COVID this summer? That story on All Things Considered from NPR News.
One of the stories on this warm afternoon coming up on KQED at 1 p.m. Then stay tuned for the world.
Inside the halls of the Pentagon, some officials are critiquing U.S. policy in Gaza, even resigning in protest. Harrison Mann is one of them. The former Army major speaks openly about the U.S. role in Gaza. Next time on The World.
Also coming up at 2, more about President Biden's executive order that allows him to close the border with Mexico when the numbers of crossing rise to a certain level. Those stories and more at 2 on The World on KQED, where support comes from the San Mateo County Fair, taking place June 1st through the 9th. The fair has all the favorites like carnival rides, amazing food, concerts, available to all with general fair admission. Tickets at sanmateocountyfair.com. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose philanthropy includes Schmidt Ocean Institute, advancing the frontiers of ocean science, exploration, and discovery. On the web at theschmidtocean.org.
Funding for Here and Now comes from Boston University's Questrom School of Business, presenting the Is Business Broken podcast, conversations about the role of business, stakeholder relations, and government at bu.edu/Questrom or wherever podcasts are available.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And for weeks, our colleague Amy McDonald has been telling us about a project her sister, Julie, is overseeing in tiny Brownsburg, Virginia, population 33 in town, a few thousand more nearby. Which is how I found myself traveling to the home of Julie Fox and her husband Chris, high on a hill overlooking miles of bright green fields, unfurling to distant mountains.
So we're in the Shenandoah Valley, in between the Blue Ridge Mountains and the Allegheny Mountains. And it's one of the prettiest places in the world. And Brownsburg has a little museum where my wife volunteers.
And as we look out on all the beauty, you know, there's a story behind this beauty. A lot of people didn't think was here, which is a story of slavery.
Right.
Yes. In 2019, preservation architect Joby Hill told Julie that Brownsburg is home to a rare cluster of still-standing stone slave houses, most being used as storage sheds. The owners cleaned them out. The museum held a one-day guided tour called Still Standing. Hundreds of people came. There was a hunger for more, but Julie is white and so is her small team.
We knew it couldn't be our project. We feel your pain kind of project. And so we started in the very beginning at the African American church and said, should we do this? Mm-hmm. And it was unanimous that it was an important story to tell. Word gets out. There's an African American man who lives in the village, and he repeated that it was Stanley Land that we needed to be talking to. And so there was a collaboration of gossip.
A small town.
Of a small town. Like, who do we need to talk to now?
Yeah. Hi, Stan.
It's good to see
Welcome.
You. Yes, thank you.
Welcome.
Yes. Stan Land.
I'm your paparazzi.
Stanley Land was born and raised in this area, was one of a handful of players who integrated football at the University of Virginia. He lives in Texas now. He's also one of the descendants of the enslaved in Brownsburg and was instrumental in putting together the exhibit he's about to see on the walls of this two-room museum for the first time with Dee Pappett, who wrote and developed the project.
Hello.
Hello, dear.
How are
good
you?
To see you?
Good to see you as well.
Welcome back.
Thank you. I'm anticipating that it's hopefully going to blow me away.
Oh, no pressure, Dean.
Yeah, no, well, let's blow you away.
The project included grad students from the University of Virginia who dug into research, Rockbridge County high schoolers who pored over tax records to find the names of enslaved people, other descendants, historians, a five-year-old who dug up artifacts on her family's property. Stan's research into his ancestors, the Halliburtons, and patriarch Jacob Halliburton, enslaved in the early 1800s, is the backbone of the exhibit.
And one of the things that we start with are all the enslaved people owned by Preston Trotter. And of course you see Jacob Halliburton's name is raised on the wall.
What is that to you to see that right at the beginning there?
Well, that's the beginning of my great-great-grandfather's life here in America. He is more or less my beginning.
You were the keeper of this family history. We would not have had this story had it not been for you.
It's my hobby. The real keeper was my grandmother, Betty Halliburton. She had collected and kept all of this history, and I was able finally to better understand what all of this meant.
Stan's sister Betty Warren and her teen daughter Elizabeth have joined us, and we're all suddenly staring into the eyes of Jacob Halliburton's son and other ancestors in sepia-toned and now watercolored enlarged photos.
Do you remember when you sent me this picture?
Yeah, I do remember it. It's awe-inspiring. It really is. It gives me chills to see that. To see both of them, to see not only him, but to see his son as well.
Just to touch our ancestors, I just touched his name on the wall, and just to see him among slaves, I just think of what they went through during that time. I think we forget about it. A friend who came to visit the museum was shaken a little bit because she didn't think that slavery existed like this in this area. What makes our family unique is that we learn to read and write. Our ancestors passed that thriving down to their children.
I just want to ask your niece real quick, what's the impact on you to see this?
I think it's really cool, especially because I feel like a lot of Black families can't go back as far as we can, so it's amazing.
So what we do is we take the visitor into history here.
The walls are covered with bills of sale for enslaved people, inventories with names listed as assets, along with sheep, cows, furniture, and then in a plastic sleeve under a glass case, a letter that William Halliburton wrote to his father Jacob from Liberia. Now, Liberia was created in Africa as a place to send freed slaves and reduce their number in America. But the trip was treacherous. William and his wife sailed with four of their five children, leaving one behind. His letter describes heartbreaking homesickness and hardship. No farm tools, no cloth for clothing. We're looking at it when Julie, again the museum director, comes in with gloves and a key. Turns out, this is the original letter. It's from the special collections at the library at Washington and Lee University, which loaned it. Julie will remove the plastic cover, take it out of the glass. Stan will hold history.
This is the actual letter.
No,
we have
I haven't seen it.
Letter.
Oh, this is the real letter?
It's the first time it's been seen by the public.
Oh, geez. Yeah, that's amazing. That's his handwriting.
Yes.
It just smacks you in the face.
You try to put yourself in his shoes, and it just makes you weep. Yeah. Did they make it?
Yeah. It was precious to someone. Someone was renovating a home here in Brownsburg, torn out some walls. This coffee can fell out of the wall. And inside the coffee can was this letter. I knew about the letter, but I've never seen the original. I had a need to understand. I have three sons. I want them to know about their family history. I want their children to know about their family history. I want them to know this is who they are.
Stan is soon in the embrace of other descendants, including 85-year-old Betty Brown, beloved longtime postmistress in Brownsburg.
Yeah, it has been. It's been that long for sure.
You haven't seen each other in 40 years?
Oh, it's been a long time.
Betty knows everything that goes on in Brownsburg, but did you know your ancestors were enslaved here?
No, I didn't.
You didn't know that?
No, I would say.
Wow, why do you think people didn't talk about that?
that's a big question. No one talked about. We just got along. Let's just say that one.
Also here, David Green, associate professor at the University of Virginia and a genealogist who discovered he's related to Stan and the Halliburtons and has other ancestors.
My fourth great-grandmother was enslaved here in Brownsburg. And so the house that she was enslaved in is still standing.
And that's where we're all going. The oldest standing slave house sits high on a hill behind a larger main house.
Good to see you. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
We meet up with other descendants and members of the project. This is a pilgrimage.
So my third great-grandfather is buried right over there. And this is a place where a very, very good chance that my fourth great-grandmother, Ann Red, was here. For a lot of us here, I mean, I come back here to show appreciation to my ancestors, really, just to say that thank you for giving me the opportunity to do the things that I am doing today.
Oh, look at this, the brick work, the wooden doors. Wow. There's a huge stone fireplace, beamed ceiling, wide floorboards. We've stepped back in time and into a reverent place. Boy, Betty Brown, did you grow up here knowing that there were
I just found out 2 years ago that this was slave quarters here, and I've lived here all my life. Yeah, my mother worked for the Reeses who lived here before.
In the main house?
In the main house, yes.
What is this for you?
I have no answer for that yet. Amazing. Yeah, amazing.
We all head off to a potluck supper. Later, I asked Julie Fox, again the project director, what should other small towns do if they're thinking about this journey?
This professor said when she came out, look around, because in these small, unchanged villages like Brownsburg, history is right there. And one of the things I've experienced is that Jacob Halliburton is a person. When I go to the museum and I'm there a lot, he is there. I can see him. And I think he must be so proud of Stan and Betty and Elizabeth. You know, those good genes of his. What a wonderful family they are.
All right. Julie Fox is the volunteer director of the tiny Brownsburg Museum in Brownsburg, Virginia. For pictures and more on the exhibit Interwoven, go to hereandnow.org.
Live from NPR News in Boston, I'm Steve Brown. The American Civil Liberties Union says it will sue over President Biden's plan to enact immediate new restrictions on migrants seeking asylum at the border. The president signed the proclamation today as the White House tries to neutralize illegal immigration as a political liability before November's elections. It caps the number of migrants who can apply for asylum when the daily average of crossings at the southern border tops 2,500. The Democratic president has contemplated unilateral action for months, especially after Republican lawmakers rejected a bipartisan security deal at the behest of presumptive GOP presidential nominee Donald Trump. Federal prosecutors are painting President Biden's son Hunter as a clear drug addict whose dark habits ensnared loved ones and who knew what he was doing when he lied on federal forms to purchase a gun in 2018. Hunter Biden has been charged with three felonies stemming from the purchase when he was, according to his memoir, addicted to crack. Palestinian health officials in Gaza say Israeli strikes killed at least 11 people overnight. A family of three was killed at a refugee camp, and eight police officers were hit in the central town of Deir al-Balah. In the occupied West Bank, the Israeli military said it killed two Palestinians who it claimed were attempting to launch a shooting attack on Israeli communities. You're listening to Here and Now.
Support for KQED comes from Symmetry, offering wealth management engineered for life in the Bay Area, celebrating 20 years of helping clients maximize opportunities like concentrated stock positions and RSUs. More at SUMMITRY.com. VisitorsCoverage.com offering both inbound U.S. and outbound U.S. travel, medical, and trip insurance, so travelers are covered for financial risks and medical emergencies wherever they go. You can learn more at VisitorsCoverage.com. This week on the Spook Podcast, Jenny and her family love their new house. Now if only that screaming would stop. That's on Spooked from Snap Judgment and KQED. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software for technical computing and model-based design. MathWorks, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. And ZSP Media, co-creator of HBO's The Jinx and WBUR, home of Last Scene, presenting a new podcast, Beyond All Repair, reinvestigating a cold case that will leave you questioning everything. Listen now.
It's Here and Now. Israel and Iran have mostly avoided hostilities since Tehran's unprecedented missile attack on Israel in April. But after Israel killed an Iranian military advisor in an airstrike in Syria yesterday, NPR's Peter Kenyon reports concerns of a wider regional conflict are growing.
Iran's direct attack on Israel, rather than using a proxy militia, has people recalculating where the conflict may be headed. On May 1st, Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei weighed in, emphasizing that, quote, Palestine must be returned to its true owners. He also called out the U.S. for sending in law enforcement to arrest student demonstrators who he said were simply voicing their disagreement with Israel's conduct of the war. This showed the world, Khamenei said, that the U.S. is Israel's partner in crime. Saddam Vakil, director of the Mideast and North Africa program at the Chatham House think tank in London, says many were relieved to see that after Iran's attack and a calibrated Israeli response, both sides have returned to their corners, at least for now. The question is, will direct attacks by Iran become the norm, or will things return to the so-called shadow war that has been Tehran's policy until now? Vakil says Iran's massive barrage may have been an effort to stop Israel's ongoing degradation of Iran's capabilities in Lebanon and Syria, most dramatically with the April 1st strike against its diplomatic mission in the Syrian capital that killed two Iranian generals.
Iran is slowly hemorrhaging its positions and people. And then with the attack on its Damascus diplomatic facilities, this was sort of the straw that broke their back and required Iran to change its terms of engagement and also make Israel perhaps in the future think twice about future attacks against Iran.
Vakil also says the attacks revealed a clear mismatch in the capabilities of Israel versus Iran. She says Iran's large-scale attack was shot down by Israel, albeit with a major assist from U.S., British, and French forces, while Israel's strike at a military target not far from important Iranian nuclear facilities sent a sharp warning to Tehran about possible consequences should such attacks continue. Professor Daniel Byman, senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, says the shooting down of almost all the Iranian missiles and drones targeting Israel should not be underestimated. Had more gotten through, he says, the political dynamic would have been very different. Byman says it makes sense to read the limited nature of the Iranian and Israeli strikes as signs both countries want to avoid a bigger conflict. But he cautions that political dynamics in both countries are unpredictable enough that should another attack occur, worries about escalation are bound to resurface.
But that, to me, is almost a likely escalation question, right? I mean, I can imagine a month from now that happening and everyone like me saying, okay, what are we going to see, right? Is this just business as usual again or not?
Byman also believes Israel will in the future be much more willing to strike in the name of national security, even in situations where it only has partial intelligence, for instance, about the nature and size of the threat. He imagines a scenario in which an Iranian military commander is traveling somewhere and Israel is debating whether to attack.
The answer in the past might be, well, you know, it's probably bad, but I'm not sure it's worth any of the effort. And now I think it's more likely to just say, take the strike. And that can lead to a lot of miscalculation.
Chatham House analyst Sanam Vakil adds that Israel may have another calculation coming up, whether to take on the Hezbollah militia in Lebanon in the coming weeks or months. Should that happen, she wonders whether or how Iran or its proxies might respond to that development. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Istanbul.
It's here and now.
The big man from Brooklyn, Fat Joe, is not just a rapper, he's also a healthcare activist.
So this is something that's very bipartisan, and it's something that affects all of the American people.
In our series, We the Voters, Fat Joe tells us why he started campaigning for cost transparency in healthcare. That's on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Catch it tomorrow on KQED2 until 9 a.m., then it's Forum. Join host Olivia Allen Price to explore all aspects of the Bay Area, from the debate over Frisco to the dinosaurs that once roamed California to the causes of homelessness. Catch new episodes of Bay Curious every Thursday on the KQED app or wherever you get your podcasts. Support for KQED comes from Brevo, a customer relationship management platform that can help engage with clients across email, SMS, WhatsApp, and more. For more info, visit brevo.com, brevo.com. Afternoon news quiz today at 5:48 p.m. When you hear the quiz question today, go to kqed.org/radionewsquiz. Enter your answer. You're going to get a chance to win a two-night stay at Canyon Ranch Woodside.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and the Music Emporium, guitar sellers for more than 50 years, celebrating the enduring presence of music made on the front porch and center stage. You can learn more at themusicemporium.com. And the Museum of Science in Boston, dedicated to inspiring a lifelong love of science in everyone, in museums, classrooms, and online, offering engineering design challenges, digital experiences, live presentations, and more. MOS.org.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Asma Khalid in Boston.
I'm Deepa Fernandez in Alameda, California. It's Here and Now. In the new book for young adults, Hurdles in the Dark, Elvira is a Hispanic girl growing up in Laredo, Texas. She runs fast, she wins medals in middle school, and she beats boys who challenge her. But when she's 14, Elvira has an even greater demand for speed. Her mother is kidnapped, and Elvira has only one day to raise $40,000 to ransom her. And so begins a different kind of sprint that wins her mother's freedom, but lands Elvira in juvenile detention. When she gets out, Elvira is determined to never go back. Athletics may provide a solution, but her natural talent brings her as much trouble as it does opportunity. Hurdles in the Dark is the memoir of author Elvira K. Gonzalez. In the book, endearing her childhood, she uses her middle name, Christy, but as an adult, she uses her first name, Elvira. Elvira, welcome to Here and Now.
Hi, I'm so excited to be on here.
I'd love to start with your early childhood. Tell me about where you grew up and about your family.
Yes, and just like you said, I am from Laredo, Texas. It is a border town. So I felt like I was growing up more in a Mexican culture than American, it seems like. And it's so vibrant. The community is amazing. But unfortunately, just because it is in a border town, there are so many challenges that young people face there. And it's just beautiful. Music, the Tejano culture, the food. I have to say the food is amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's dive in, because when you're barely a teen, you're just 14, your mother is kidnapped by narcos while she's at a wedding reception in Mexico, just across the border from where you live. You, being a teenager with some attitude, were not kidnapped because you refused to accompany your mum to the wedding, which ends up likely saving all your lives. And we don't want to give away too much about what happens, but I want you to talk about what it felt like as a 14-year-old to get that call from kidnappers and realize that you had to save your mother's life.
I couldn't believe that things like that would happen to me. You know, you hear that in the newspaper where I'm from or about other people in my community, but never really thought that would happen to my family. It's very shocking. Definitely felt like it was a dream, and those 24 hours just went by really, really fast. So much happened in that time, and I really do think that that experience in that moment kind of made me grow up really fast because I kind of had to.
Yeah, and what was amazing too was that the people who stepped up to save your mom, and stepped up meaning like put their hard-earned cash down, were some of the poorest people in your neighborhood. Talk to me about that, because, you know, there were wealthy people who your mom knew who really didn't offer much help. It was people with very little who gave everything they had.
That was shocking to me, right? As a 14-year-old, like, well, let's talk to the people who have a lot of money. I'm sure they would give us money. But unfortunately, that didn't happen. Also, in a place like Laredo, where the kidnappings do happen, it's something you hear about growing up. I don't know if that was the issue, that people didn't want to know that people gave money and they might be a target. But at the end of the day, yeah, my friends, my teenage friends who were also 14 at the time and grew up in lower income communities, they got their families to give money to the ransom, and also my mother's friends. So I was pretty surprised about that.
You know, after your mom survives the kidnapping and you all are a family again, things are never the same. You know, I think I had this hope that everything's going to be okay, but your mom's traumatized, you're traumatized. She can't really parent you, and she ends up calling the police on you, and you end up in juvie. You didn't do anything to deserve juvenile detention. Why did your mom do that?
I think at the end, my mom was just kind of really overwhelmed. She was only 32 at the time, and I'm actually 32 now, and I can't imagine what I would do or how I would feel going through something like that. But on the other side, it was very scary. I didn't know what I was going to do because I knew I was going to go to juvenile hall. And I tried to tell, you know, the police, like, hey, like this is due to, you know, the kidnapping. Can you please take me somewhere else? And, you know, I probably sound like a crazy person telling the story about the kidnapping. But so I went to juvenile hall, and it was just very, very scary. One of the scariest things I think I've gone through. I mean, the kidnapping as well, but definitely being in a cell and it's dark and it's just, I was a kid.
So you survive a kidnapping of your mom. You survive juvenile detention. Let's get to your athletics, because it almost seemed like this was the part that saved you. And you saw hurdling as a way to get to college, something that's very out of reach for others in your community. But you have to break into your school at like 5 a.m., jump a locked fence in the dark just to access a running track to be able to practice. You watch YouTube videos to coach yourself. Why?
Something about the hurdles was just, I was gravitating towards that, knowing that I'm not good at it, but I think that I can. If I put my mind into it and practice, this could be my ticket to get an education and be the first one in my family to do so. Mm. So, yeah, I would crawl up the fence and hoping I don't get caught and end up back in juvenile hall. Because it's dark, you could barely see me. So I learned to hurdle in the dark. And, it was definitely challenging, but I definitely think that helped me become a stronger hurdler.
And you end up finding a coach, a man in his late 30s who agrees to coach you for free. But then this coach, it turns out he actually did want something from you.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. After training, I thought he was like a father figure, you know, spending so much time with him and him getting to know my story and why I wanted to do this, why it meant a lot to me. And I think to become an elite athlete, there's definitely strong relationships between coach and athlete, but it could become blurry, right? If there's no boundaries, like strong boundaries. So that definitely happened. And we had an inappropriate relationship and it just turned very, very unhealthy.
And you kind of experienced as a teenager sexual abuse by two coaches. Why couldn't you tell anyone as it was happening?
At the time, I felt that no one was going to believe me, because how could these amazing coaches in our community, how could they do this to someone like me and other young girls, right? There were other young girls with the other coach. So I just didn't think that anyone would believe me. And I was thinking about my future, like if I say something, are they going to take away my opportunities? This is my way out, my ticket to freedom. Mm. And also feeling like I needed to honor this secret between me and my private coach was always hanging in my head, and feeling
so
like
much to carry.
Yeah, it was a lot for a teenager, anyone in general, but definitely after going through all the kidnapping and the juvenile hall, I was like, my mother is going to be in so much distress.
So you were constantly protecting others. And you say this in your book, how few other Latinas there are in athletics. And I imagine that made it even harder for you.
Yes, yes, definitely.
And then you make it through high school, you make it through all of these experiences, and you go on to be a coach yourself. You get to work with young people of color in athletics, especially girls. What do you bring to coaching that comes from your own experience of being coached?
I try to be very aware of the boundaries, and I'm hoping that I've taught kids about boundaries, because that's very essential for sports. And then there's a lot of complexities in coaching, and I don't know if people are aware of it, but the sexual abuse part is I would say is common, and I've heard it among my own athletes, and it's very scary. So I hope that I've taught my athletes about boundaries.
And for us, you're coaching young people to write now, to tell their stories. You have a whole section of resources for girls who might be in the same situation as you are at the back of your book. What's the message you most want to send to those girls?
Yes, to not only girls and young boys, both, I would like to share that they are not alone and their voice matters. And so if anyone's going through something similar, definitely there are resources in the back of the book, but definitely talking to someone who is a trusted family member or a counselor, that's very important, especially when I mentioned the boundaries. And also that their story matters, right? Often we're like, oh, our story doesn't matter, but it does matter. And it matters to a lot of people and to me.
Well, congratulations on the book, Elvira K. Gonzalez. Her new book for young adults, Hurdles in the Dark. It's a page-turner. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Stay tuned to KQBD for All Things Considered after Here and Now. Coming up at the top of the hour, it may be tempting to forget about COVID this summer, but with increased travel and indoor gatherings, scientists expect a new wave. What to expect from COVID over these next few months? That story and the rest of the day's news starting at 1. Support for KQBD comes from San Francisco Main Library. Presenting Ralph Chazet, A San Francisco Century, The Untold Story of the Renaissance Man, Coit Tower Muralist and Father of the Children's Program, Brother Buzz, sfpl.org, to plan your visit. Supermicro and NVIDIA, accelerating AI with a wide range of AI servers and the NVIDIA AI Enterprise Software Platform. Supermicro is committed to driving AI infrastructure breakthroughs with rack-scale innovations.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and your NPR station, and MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software for technical computing and model-based design. MathWorks, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. And WBUR with ZSP Media, presenting Beyond All Repair, a new podcast investigating an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything and everyone. Listen now.
It's Here and Now. Today in Beijing, Chinese authorities have heightened security around Tiananmen Square. It's the 35th anniversary of the massacre in and on the streets around that historic square when the Chinese military was called in to stop the student-led pro-democracy protest. Troops opened fire on the crowd, killing hundreds, maybe thousands of people. There's no official death toll. The Chinese Communist Party has essentially tried to erase the event from history. Discussion of what happened in any commemoration of June 4th, 1989 is forbidden in China. But Chinese people living around the world are working to keep the memory of Tiananmen Square alive. Yangyang Cheng is one of them. She's a research scholar and fellow at Yale Law School. Yangyang, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you were born in 1989. In fact, you've written that your mother was pregnant with you during this massacre in Tiananmen Square. How did the crackdown shape the China that you grew up in?
For the entire 19 years I lived in China, I did not know what happened. However, with that said, the China I grew up in was profoundly shaped by the events of 1989 and the response to the Tiananmen demonstrations. After the Mao era disasters, the public had lost their faith in communist ideology, and the government needed new ways to buttress their legitimacy. And so the government turned to one thing that was nationalism, or as it would call patriotism. And one important note in terms of for myself, as someone who was born shortly after, was the government implemented this patriotic education program.
So I want to ask you about that. Did you learn anything about the events in elementary school, high school? Was it acknowledged at all in the school curriculum or broadly in life?
When I was in middle school, in our middle school textbooks at the time in the early 2000s, what took place at Tiananmen in 1989 was mentioned very, very briefly in this pithy Chinese phrase, a political incident in 1989 between spring and summer. And that was all. But I think one thing that is important to also take note here is that the government did not immediately implement blanket censorship. In the immediate aftermath of the crackdown, the government used propaganda, including TV documentaries and specials and all these programs, to portray the demonstrations as a counter-revolutionary riot and to portray the martial law troops as the guardians of the People's Republic. And that went on for quite a while. But I think this also shows the limitations of the government's power to reshape a narrative, that that strategy completely failed. So that was why by the early 1990s, the government started this new strategy of blank censorship of the event.
Okay. So you moved to the United States in 2009, and you write that one of the first things you did when you arrived was Google Tiananmen Square. Why did you want to do that, and what did you find out?
It was a moment of political awakening for me, and it was a very transformative moment. And I also should say that I am not alone in this. Like, for a lot of Chinese people of my generation or a bit younger, finding out the truth about Tiananmen in a way similar as I did is a very politically informative process for them as well.
What did you think about what you discovered?
So I think it's a very painful realization. It feels like a form of severance, that the pain is almost physical, that even if someone like myself, who did not hold illusions about the authoritarian nature of the Chinese government, to be faced with the extent of the brutality, to be faced with that bloody truth, is still a very, very difficult moment. One thing that is also important is there is no closure. So it remains an open wound, and it remains a point of grief.
You wrote a piece in The Nation magazine this week, and it was really thought-provoking. You say that as you're thinking about Tiananmen Square, you can't help but think about the student-led protests against the war in Gaza that have sprung up around a number of college campuses here in the United States this spring. I'm curious what you see as the lessons of Tiananmen Square here in the United States.
The lessons from Tiananmen for what is taking place on U.S. campuses here, I think it's multifold. One thing that is very important is that remembering is not a binary. It's not just a dichotomy between amnesia and awareness. There is a very important question to be asked, is what is being remembered, who remembers, and what purpose it serves. And so for the past 35 years, Tiananmen is being remembered in a very flattened, tokenized way, a marker of Chinese brutality and barbarism without an actual reflection of how this is a reflection of state violence and state oppression that can manifest in many different forms and effectively anywhere. And I think some of that can be seen in the brutal crackdowns of the campus protests here.
Yangyang Cheng is a research scholar and fellow at Yale Law School. Yangyang, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Asma Khalid in Boston.
And I'm Vipa Fernandez in Alameda, California. Thanks for spending some time with us. The latest news is next. It's Here and Now.
funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and Rhodes Scholar, a not-for-profit educational travel organization offering adventures for adults in more than 100 countries. Learn more at roadscholar.org/explore.
The big man from Brooklyn, Fat Joe, is not just a rapper, he's also a healthcare activist.
So this is something that's very bipartisan, and it's something that affects all of the American people.
In our series, We the Voters, Fat Joe tells us why he started campaigning for cost transparency in healthcare. That's tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starts tomorrow.